Thank you for standing by. Today's conference is now being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Thank you. You may begin.
Okay, again, this is Bob Firevid with USDA. Today's speaker is Brian Duddy of the Rochester Institute of Technology, and he'll be talking about the DOT-funded research on E20, 20% ethanol, and gasoline. Usage in vehicles with conventional IC engines. So if you have any questions during Brian's talk that about clarification questions on a particular slide, please ask them at that point. Otherwise, hold your questions until the end. We will have a Q&A session at the end. So with that, I'll turn it over to Brian. Thank you, Brian.
Okay, thank you, Bob. Yeah, today I'll be discussing an overview of our E20 test and evaluation program going on here in Rochester, New York, and Monroe County. The slides are numbered at the bottom right-hand corner. I'll try to refer to the number as often as possible so everybody can keep up. Slide 2 gives you the overview of what I'm going to talk about today, a little background on how the program got started, what our test objectives were, some complexion about the E20 study vehicle fleets, what our emissions testing plan was for the E20 vehicles, some of our test results to date, which I think are the major interest item here today, how we go about doing our fleet monitoring program, and some remaining issues with our program. So slide 3 gives you the program background. In July of 2007, just about 3 years ago, we were asked by DOT to do a study on 10 vehicles at a minimum running on E20 conventional vehicles in support of the government's 20 in 10 initiative. We were already in the midst of a research program on ethanol, biodiesel, and hydrogen. In the ethanol area, we were looking primarily at the performance of E85 in the flex fuel fleet that was owned by the Monroe County government, which is our neighbor here. The DOT asked us specifically to find some conventional vehicles in a year range of about 4 to 7 years old at that time that had not regularly been exposed to E10 ethanol. They wanted to basically start with a clean slate and expose them to E20. We talked with the county. They agreed at that time to dedicate a 10-vehicle set to running on E20. That vehicle set came out to be mostly light-duty trucks and a sedan. We selected older vehicles, and the county had in mind that they were vehicles that might not be in their inventory very long, just in case something were to go wrong with them on E20. They weren't going to be brand-new vehicles that were going to risk a lot of damage.
Hey, Brian?
Yes?
Quick thing, I forgot. Can we do a very quick roll call just so we know everybody's...
Certainly. Go ahead.
Bob, do you have other people on the line there that maybe could speak up?
No.
Okay. From DOT, we have
Tom Bowman, Office of Defects Investigation over at NHTSA.
Greg Powell, CAFE Rulemaking.
Joe Caro, Vehicle Safety at NHTSA.
Beth Kahn with Sustainable Transport.
General Counsel's Office.
Claude Harris, NHTSA Enforcement.
Excellent. Sorry about that. I let that slip my mind, but continue on.
Okay, thanks. So the county agreed to dedicate some vehicles to the program, and in the fall of 2007, we set up the program with a dedicated fuel storage area. We developed driver cards for driver evaluations. We installed vehicle monitoring systems on the 10 vehicles, and we put together a plan for emissions testing for both E0 and E20. In November 2007, we began to baseline the 10 vehicles on E0 fuel in emissions. Slide number 4 gives you a little bit of overview about the Monroe County area here in upstate New York, a fairly large 1,300-square-mile region with 4 seasons of worth of testing. We have access to a diverse vehicle set with multiple drivers, both city and rural driving. Slide 5 discusses actually the Monroe County vehicle fleet itself. At present, the program has changed considerably. We now, in fact, have about 300 conventional light-duty vehicles running on E20 fuel on a daily basis. This is a change from our baseline program. In addition to that, the county has about 100 flex fuel vehicles that are running both on E20 and E85, and 100 sheriff vehicles, the Ford Crown Vicks, which run on a combination of E20 and E85. They're also flex fuel sheriff vehicles. In addition, the county has gone, to try to go to alternative fuel in a large way on their entire fleet. They have a large heavy-duty fleet which operates on mixtures of biodiesel. They have hybrids. They were receiving some of the first-generation battery-powered vehicles, and they operated a GM Equinox fuel cell vehicle under Project Driveway over the last 2 years. As part of this program, they also constructed a new green fueling station, which hosts the biodiesel, ethanol blends, hydrogen, and now CNG. So slide 6 now gives the test objectives that we developed for this E20 program. We were primarily interested from the DOT to look at the impact to the public of E20 operation in conventional vehicles, specifically drivability. I think their immediate concern was that if certain states, for example, Minnesota, implemented E20 on a statewide basis and people were driving through Minnesota with a conventional vehicle, they were wondering, well, if I have to fill up on this, is there going to be any damage to my vehicle at all? So I think that was the primary objective. In addition, we developed some objectives to look at the emissions deltas between E0 and E20, some impact to the vehicle fleets in terms of durability and maintenance frequency. We were going to track the fuel economy versus the E0 operation, and eventually the life cycle cost of the E20 fuel to the county government budget. We also will report, as we find them, on supply chain issues with ethanol fuel, which there were very many at the beginning of our program. Slide 7 gives you the actual 10-vehicle study fleet. These were the 10 vehicles we began the study with in 2007. You see they range model years from 98 to 2004. Various mileages and vehicle configurations, mostly light-duty vehicles. I think the van was probably the largest one that we had in the fleet. And these were everyday work vehicles that travel the county roads every day, so they see a wide range of drivers and usages. Current mileage now there on the right-hand column tells you basically about how many miles they have on them as of the end of last month. So our leading vehicle on ethanol has about 35,000 to 40,000 miles on it on E20 so far. Slide number 8 now discusses our emissions testing plan. We were looking to gather tailpipe emissions from this 10-vehicle study group specifically. So the way we approached this was we established the baseline for the vehicles on the E0 road fuel in the November-December 2007 timeframe. And there we collected the 5 gases that you see on the left-hand column, and we recorded those on the vehicles that had been running on E0 basically for their whole life.
One question for you, Brian.
Yes.
NMHC, is that non-methane hydrocarbons?
Yes.
And THC?
Total hydrocarbons.
Total hydrocarbons.
Yeah. And all this testing was done on a dynamometer at the Delphi Technical Center here in Rochester, New York, which is just a couple miles away from us. So we were very fortunate to have that facility available to do this work. There's some more information about that a little further on. So after the vehicles were baseline tested and unleaded, they went to E20 in around the February 2007 timeframe. Once we got the logistics issues worked out, we had them running on E20 fuel. Then we brought the vehicles back in the summer of 2008 and did the emissions testing over again. This time we used the E20 fuel so we would have a comparison. Once that had been completed, we looked forward to see when we could do that again to detect any kind of degradation. And so last summer, August through November 2009, we did a very comprehensive large-scale back-to-back testing with the vehicles, same 10 vehicles again, this time with both E0 and E20 back-to-back. And we collected not only the standard five gases, but the ethanol in the exhaust stream using some equipment and support from the folks at NREL. They came out and helped us and participated with us in the testing. Slide 9 talks about some of the features of our emissions testing program. Again, they were done at the Delphi Technical Center here in Rochester. We measured basically criteria pollutants using the standard FTP 75 drive cycle evaluation. We performed on these vehicles three runs on each fuel to make sure that if there weren't any anomalies, we had good data, and if there were any anomalies, the test was rerun to make sure we got three good samples. And that happened once or twice, I think, but overall we had pretty good luck with the emissions testing. For those of you who are interested, it's a Hariba series emissions analyzer. And again, in November 2009, the NREL folks brought out some additional equipment to measure ethanol emissions in the exhaust stream. And we have to emphasize these are not test vehicles so much as prototypes, but they're real-world work vehicles, and they are on the road every day, and this was kind of a new thing for Delphi to test actual road vehicles as opposed to manufacturer's prototypes. Slide 10 shows some of the inside of the Delphi emissions lab there. You can see one of the county trucks on the dynamometer with the driver trace screen on the left, the tailpipe emissions collector, and then the bottom right is the emissions bench in the control room. And slide 11 gives you kind of the details about the Delphi emissions testing lab in the Hariba system. So slide 12 kind of talks about our program timeline. Again, July 2007 was our request from the DOT, and by August we had the 10 vehicles identified. November 2007, our first set of vehicle emissions. 2008, June, our second set. After about a year of operation on this E20 fuel, the county was so happy with the performance of the vehicles that they decided they wanted to put their whole fleet on E20, all their conventional vehicles. So at that time, we thought it was probably prudent for us to go forward to the EPA and get a waiver for this test program on a large scale. And so we did that in September 2008, went to EPA and got a waiver for the full-scale test program. In October 2008, we conducted interviews with all the drivers for the 10 study vehicles to get their impressions of driving on the E20 fuel. By December 2008, the county had a contract in place to get regular deliveries of E20 from a blender for their conventional vehicle fleet. So that's when they went to the 300 vehicles. August 2009, we did our emissions testing again. Last December, we had a paper published on the first round of results from our emissions testing in the Journal of Automotive Engineering. And then November of this year, our program will be completed.
So, a quick question for you.
Sure.
The ethanol that you're having blended, that's blended on site, or is it shipped already blended? A question being that, have there been any degradation issues with the fuel, or it's pretty much full-grade ethanol blended on site?
Initially, it was blended on site because we couldn't find somebody willing to transport or blend E20 for us. So we had to buy ethanol separately and splash blend it with gasoline to get the E20 mixture that we needed. But we had a method here to test the fuel to ensure it was at least 20%. So we tested that on a frequent basis. When the county went to the full-scale implementation of E20, they were able to find a blender who would supply it by truck to them on a weekly basis.
Thank you. One more question from the field.
Sure.
Hi, this is Greg Powell, CAFE Rulemaking. And I'm wondering, I was just leafing through the remainder of the slides. Maybe you'll answer this later on, but you'd said they were so happy with it that they expanded it to the fleet, to the whole fleet.
They reported all the drivers reported good performance on the fuel. They saw a slight increase in acceleration because of the increased oxygen. The county has a strategy overall to reduce dependence on petroleum. So when they saw that there weren't any problems with the vehicles and the drivers were basically happy with it, they decided to implement this as part of their overall strategy on petroleum reduction, in addition to the E85 and the biodiesel and things like that. So they weren't seeing any problems, and they thought it was a good investment they were going to make, so they went forward with it.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, this is Bob. I just ask again, everybody, if you have a clarifying question to that you don't understand something on the slide, then please go ahead and ask. Otherwise, just please let the presenter get through his presentation first, and we make sure we have enough time. Okay, thanks.
Okay, slide 13 now talks about our emissions test results. This is probably the heart of what everybody's interested in, and the back-to-back data we have between E0 and E20 shows a significant improvement in hydrocarbons and carbon monoxide emissions. You can see there's a close to a 14% decrease in hydrocarbon and close to a 27% decrease in carbon monoxide. We were watching CO2 carefully also, and that came out to be a wash. It wasn't statistically significant for the CO2 deltas. Now, we did compare the results from the first run to the second run, and we have seen some degradation in the emissions on the vehicles over time, and that was expected. So that wasn't a surprise to us. The chart on the slide on the right, the symbology there, the little squares and triangles, those are the particular vehicle numbers, just to reference what you're looking at. Chart 14, again, the emissions test results were for the criteria pollutants, and all the measurements for both fuels were well below the EPA limit for criteria pollutants. So although there was some ups and downs, all of them were well below the limits. We did do one cold start testing on one of the vehicles at the end of our test last summer to see what the data would look like at 20 degrees. We did see some expected degradation in hydrocarbon and CO during the cold start phase, which was what we expected. However, it was less, so it was actually better for E20 than for E0. So that was another kind of useful data point. And the vehicle did start at 20 degrees F. That was another concern we had, was cold starting.
Just to clarify, just for my own sake here, degradation in HD and CO, are you saying that you weren't seeing as high a reduction in those levels? Or?
Yeah, that it was, that they're, in comparison to the ambient temperature, you're getting more emissions, which is what we expected with a cold start. So in addition to the emissions work, we did...
Another clarifying question here?
Yes.
Just a quick thing, and when I was working in the auto industry, a cold start would be something more like, you know, minus 40 degrees, like frigid. So I'm a little interested in the 20 degree selection. Is that consistent with other testing you fellas have been doing, or?
Well, this is actually something that Delphi requested to do. We had not had this as part of our test plan. They asked to have it done because they wanted to see what the impacts would be. So they selected that 20 degrees F standard. We did not.
Is there any consideration to subarctic temperatures?
Yeah, I suppose there is. I mean, we watch that carefully here in Rochester when it gets to zero or below. We haven't seen any great difficulties in starting the vehicles at that temperature.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So in addition to the emissions data, we also were concerned with the changes in fuel economy from the E0 to the E20. So what we've done is we've looked at the fueling data for the vehicles that are out there in the fleet and tried to come up with some sort of a metric for the fuel economy deltas. So what we've seen is using a kind of a narrow set of 47 vehicles that met the criteria of minimum 20 data points for fuel, staying within the same organization, so we got consistent information and at least 1 year of usage. We've seen on road that there's a decrease of about 6% in fuel economy from E0 to E20. We calculated based on fuel energy, we expected almost a 7% reduction based on the fuel energy. And from our calculations at Delphi during the emissions test, we expected about a 6.5% reduction based on the carbon emissions during the dynamometer testing. So basically there's a, you know, around a 6 or 7% reduction in fuel economy running the vehicles on E20. And this was consistent with our expectations based on the energy content of the fuel. Now what we've seen, though, looking at the data from the fleet vehicles, is that seasonal variations and usage changes can also drive fuel economy deltas even greater than the fuel. So we're trying to assess the impact on the consumer here and how much of an impact the E20 usage would be as compared to other factors which influence fuel economy. We looked at, for example, the seasonal variations there, and you can see for one vehicle, the top chart on page 16, the seasonal variations in fuel economy over the course of a year and how that varies for fuel for standard E0 fuel. Also, the chart on the bottom shows a delta in emission change where the vehicle was operating at the hospital for a while and then it was rebadged and sent out to work at the pump station, and you see a dramatic increase in fuel economy there. So just in terms of context for fuels, lots of things can make a difference on fuel economy besides just the fuel you're using. Slide 17 discusses our drivability results. As I mentioned, the drivers for the county filled out fueling and performance cards for at least one calendar year of operation on the E20 fuel for the 10 vehicle fleet. You can see a sample of that card there on the lower right-hand corner of the slide. The statistics were very good. The drivers had good experience with the E20. They were comfortable with it in their vehicle, and 8 out of the 10 said that they would use E20 in their personal vehicle. Now, this was significant to us because the county fleet manager told us that when they started the program, all the drivers were skeptical about E20. They didn't think this was going to turn out to be a very good idea at all, but they went ahead with it anyway. And so far, they had no driving issues, primarily positive comments. And as I mentioned, the high mileage vehicle now has well over 30,000 miles on E20. Slide 18 discusses our use of the network car vehicle monitoring system. This was a unit that we had on some of our other vehicles in the program, and we decided to install these systems on board all 10 of the E20 study vehicles. And these are commercial off-the-shelf systems that are linked into the OBD network on the vehicle. And they provide a GPS location through a cell phone link. They record speed ranges, idle time, and the most important thing for us was maintenance alert when the vehicle detects a fault or failure. So the system will immediately send an email to my desk saying, you know, bad oxygen sensor on vehicle XYZ, or check engine light has illuminated on these vehicles, so we can know instantly if there's a problem and try to trace that back to the fuel system. So far, we haven't seen any serious issues at all with the E20 fuel. We've had no check engine light illuminations due to that. So far, the results have been very positive. Slide 19 kind of talks to our evaluation of the vehicle maintenance information. We collect data on all the Monroe County vehicles and put it into a database here, which we keep to analyze both for fueling entries and for maintenance entries. So we can analyze fuel use, maintenance events, maintenance cost, and look at total cost of ownership. Right now, we're in the process of going through the data for the E20 vehicles, the conventional fleet, and trying to pick out critical system failures if they occur and see if that's different than the normal trend for the E0 vehicles that we have in the database. So we're kind of in the process of doing a full-scale total cost of ownership evaluation right now.
Got a question from the field?
Could yes.
Completion date for that, please?
I'm sorry?
Completion date?
Probably be this summer, I think, because our overall program will be complete by November of this year.
Will that be released in advance of the paper, or maybe over one of these phone conferences, or any idea about that?
Well, our complete report altogether will be sent to DOT, and within there will be modules for fuel economy, for total cost of ownership, for emissions, and then our overall report for all of our fuels will have a technology readiness evaluation of all of them. That includes the hydrogen and the biodiesel as well. So that will be all provided to DOT. Subsets of those we will publish, you know, individually, but we don't have a date for that just yet. But all the work is going to need to be done by November. So if there's any other publishing done, it'll occur this summer or this fall.
Thank you.
So slide 20 is just kind of an overview of our research here. This program is a unique partnership between us at the university, the Monroe County government, and the folks at Delphi. We've been very fortunate to partner with them and learn quite a bit about emissions testing at their facility. This project has by far the largest and most comprehensive group of E20 vehicles on the road right now, considering vehicle types, ages, weather, numbers of drivers, distance that they cover. The 10 study vehicles, which are our original vehicles, have driven over 200,000 miles on E20. The larger fleet, which is the 300 vehicle fleet, has consumed over 300,000 gallons of E20 and driven well over 4 million miles on it so far. As I mentioned, the results of this program will be folded into our overall assessment of the technology readiness of the alternative fuels in our study. And the E20 and E85 are being evaluated along with the biodiesel and our hydrogen ICE cars, which we have here on campus. A few issues remaining with this evaluation now. Understand we are only a small part of the mid-level blends group that's working on mid-level blends. There's a great number of people now, the auto industry, the fuel industry, the folks at NREL, Department of Energy, EPA, working on the mid-level blends, primarily for support of this E15 waiver. That's kind of the key driving factor right now. And so we are just a small part of the group. Our DOT research grant finishes in November of this year. We've identified some other issues, though, and that's we are concerned about the impact of ethanol on the so-called aftermarket components. We know that when you take your vehicle back to the dealer, it'll be fixed with an OEM part, but people who do their own maintenance may go to AutoZone or Pep Boys and get an aftermarket part and install it, and we're not sure what the impact of this ethanol fuel is going to be on that aftermarket component survey. The industry and the government must still evaluate the motorcycle and the recreational vehicle fleets. That's the snowmobiles, the ATVs, and particularly the marine industry. They have concerns about E20 fuel, and so that work still needs to be done pretty quick here before E20 can be accepted as a widespread fuel. The county, as I mentioned, is so happy with E20, they want to continue using it in their vehicles, but our testing waiver will expire with our DOT program unless someone else picks us up to continue it on, which we'd still like to do, because as the last bullet says, we likely won't get to see E20 used over the full useful life of many, if any, of these vehicles before November. Probably we assume we'll get maybe 50,000 miles maybe on a couple of the vehicles before November, but we'd like to have a lot more time on them to see what the long-term impact of durability is. So summary, slide 22. We were able to execute, I think, a pretty effective test and evaluation program for E20 on a pretty aggressive timeline here to support DOT's initiative. Neither us nor the county have uncovered any adverse effects of E20 on their vehicle fleet. This comes straight from the county fleet managers. We question them often about the E20 performance, and we never get any bad reports. They have a lot more maintenance headaches and reliability issues that bother them, and so this is really very minimal for them to worry about. Fuel mileage is impacted with E20, but the results were as expected. The tailpipe emissions are either a wash or in some cases significantly lower. The drivers are happy with E20, but right now the total ownership cost for it is to be determined. It's going to depend on the supply chain, whether subsidies are still enforced, tax credits, et cetera. Our evaluation with the county is a little bit skewed because they're able to buy gasoline, regular gasoline, off a state contract, so they get it a lot cheaper than the average motorist will get it. So we'll have to use some commercial data to fill in some of the gaps on the ownership cost. So that's my presentation for today, and I'd be happy to take any of your questions.
I just have one question, Claude Harris, on NHTSA enforcement. Have you discussed this with the EPA in terms of them getting some kind of continued exemption for the use of E20, and whether or not it'd be extended across the board for widespread application? Or is this going to be done on a case-by-case basis?
Not formally, although this presentation that I showed today is the same one I gave a couple weeks ago in Washington at the Mid-Level Blends Ethanol Coordination Group meeting. And there were several representatives from EPA there in the room at that time, and I basically said, kind of the same thing, that our program is running out in November. If anybody wants to keep it going, we need some cover for that. So we haven't gone forward to them to ask for a formal continuation, because we're still kind of searching for maybe a program that might pick up where this one leaves off.
Is EPA have any interest in trying to extend this program for certification of new vehicles? They have a whole process in place to certify for emissions, both initially and at 50,000 miles. If there's some advantages to using E20 beyond what you've identified here, is EPA expressing interest to try to promote the use of this, through the normal vehicle chain process?
Is this question for me or the EPA reps?
Well, I assume that this is a pilot program to see if there are any adverse effects, and again, the next portion of it would be, okay, if you wanted to apply it across the board, what kind of governmental bottlenecks you're going to run into to make it easily usable for those that have an interest.
Yeah. Well, from our standpoint, we would like to continue the program. I mean, we had some ideas for some further work we might do, and one of those was what you just mentioned, was starting with brand new vehicles that could go from basically delivery on E20, and we would monitor those very carefully, as far as tear down inspections and that kind of thing, to look at the impact of E20 on the full useful life. The program we have now, we kind of started in the middle of the vehicle's life, so they had a lot of experience with E0 unleaded, so trying to compare durability results is kind of difficult, because you don't know what the vehicles have gone through their earlier life. But if we could capture that from day one, I think that would be a much better study. But as far as whether the EPA wants to continue our program or not, I don't have any indications on that.
Thanks.
Go ahead, Tom. Brian, this is not for you. This is probably for DOT, but I want to put it in the footnote here. Our agency was approached by General Motors a couple months ago, and they were expressing concern to us about performance compromises with the E20, specifically things like stalling and bucking and performance issues. And I heard very clearly, you walked through the performance with the people that used the E20 in their vehicle fleet, and I think I need to
that on the table, but we also need to find out where's the gap in that point. Either the vehicles in this fleet aren't the same match for the vehicles that GM's concerned about, or the GM concern is overstated. But in any event, GM wants to come and have a joint meeting with EPA and our division of NHTSA in mid-June to reconcile that. And again, our deal is not, you know, the miles per gallon, the fuel economy, or anything. It's the performance, it's the safety. It's going to leave vehicles stranded. You know, is there some safety consequence? And again, Brian, that's not so much for you. It's just something that we need to internalize here and make sure we're comprehensive in our look at this.
Well,
go ahead.
I can tell you one thing, that the county has had more problems with their flex fuel vehicles on E85 than they've had with their conventional vehicles on E20.
Oh. Okay.
So, like, for example, their Chevy Uplanders, they said, have had a rash of issues on E85 and had to have their software reflashed and stuff because they were having starting problems.
That would be a more radical technology, so understandable, I would think.
Yeah.
Well, that's sort of why I'm not completely familiar with this, but my understanding from PHMSA, from pipelines, is that we were talking about the transport of ethanol through pipelines and in other shipment containers, it's uneconomical to ship pre-blended fuels because there's degradation issues from the source of shipment to the end destination. So possibly, and I don't know, but I almost wonder if some of these issues with knocking and installing might have to do with variations in the fuel quality as opposed to blending at stations.
It could be that. It could be an overinflated statement.
I mean, I'm not making a...
Yeah. But the point is, it's been raised, and I think we need to make sure we reconcile.
Right.
I mean, our county folks go through fuel pretty fast, so it doesn't really have a chance to get stale in the tank. They're refueling, you know, now that they've got the full fleet on it, probably twice a week they're getting a fill-up. So we go over there now, we're going twice a week, now we go at least once a week and test the fuel to make sure it's E20 percentage-wise.
Just to add a little more footnote to a footnote, the issue, and it's secondhand to me, so I'm not speaking with great authority, has to do with the ability of the engine's ECU to anticipate and respond to the fuel that it was seeing. And perhaps in the older vehicles, they simply weren't programmed in anticipation to some of these fuel combinations.
Well, you know, we expected that. In fact, when we started this program, we had planned for extremely worst case. I mean, we were looking at extra funding to buy fuel filters and fuel pumps and stuff. We were expecting a rash of failures initially because of the situation where the alcohol in the fuel was going to clean out the fuel system and flush all those, contaminants into the fuel filter and clog the filter. So we were kind of pre-positioned for trouble, but we didn't see it. And then we thought also there would be software issues with short-term, long-term trim and that kind of thing. But we haven't really detected any.
Well, that part of the project's fine, but I think also somebody perhaps from your group might want to join for our session.
Sure.
We all get
that'd
together.
Be great.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
I had a quick comment. Brian, we've talked about this briefly before. I know that the CO2 emissions were somewhat of a wash, but my eyes kind of popped out over the carbon monoxide emission reductions. The on-road transportation sector was representative of about, I think it's about 70% of carbon monoxide emissions that the United States produces.
Mm-hmm.
CO reduces the oxidizing capacity of methane in the atmosphere, which essentially extends the lifespan, the global warming potential. So indirectly, carbon monoxide plays a rather significant role in increasing the warming potential methane. So even though there's a wash in CO2, there might be some potential climate change benefits from the reduction in CO and the indirect of methane. Now, of course, the upstream effects for the production of ethanol is a whole other bill of beans, and if I understand correctly, you guys did not get into that part of your analysis.
Well, actually, we did. It'll come out in our final report, but okay. What we've done is we've run the GREET model for both E0 and E20 to find out what the comparison of the emissions are. Now, unfortunately, the GREET model doesn't handle tailpipe emissions very well. So we're kind of limited in that way that we have some numbers, but They're not as exact as we'd like them to be because the model won't allow us to get better granularity in the tailpipe area. It basically assumes, you know, the EPA numbers, if you will, the window sticker numbers for emissions in miles per gallon. So we'll have some stuff, but it probably won't be as good as we'd like it to be, I think.
Okay.
Other questions for Brian?
This is Todd Whiting at Deer. Getting back to this issue of switching fuels, I think the concern, I don't mean to speak for GM and Ford, but isn't the issue, though, if you've been driving your vehicle around with E0 and you run it, you know, down to empty and you fill it with E20, that's where the fuel trims get to be an issue. And I think you ran these vehicles on E20 all the time. Is that correct?
True. Yeah, I mean, they converted from E0 to E20 at one point, and then they've just run on E20 since then.
So I think the problem that could exist is the quick switch of fuel is, and I don't know, there's probably a difference between newer vehicles and older ones in terms of how those fuel trims are handled, but I suspect that's the concern, I think. It's probably a legitimate concern.
Yeah, and the conversion process, I mean, depending on how much fuel you have in your tank when you switch over, you know, how much it's diluted. I mean, you may, although, of course, now almost everywhere around here is E10, so you're already at that level when you start.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I think it's probably your worst-case situation.
Other questions for Brian?
Just a minor one. Again, this is Tom. The details on the driver's interviews, I mean, you got a sample interview form here. Are those details, do we wait for the final report to see that as an appendix, or how does that get?
Yeah, all that will be included with the final report summarized. I think we're going to do like standalone kind of modules. You know, there'll be an E20 module. There'll be the E85 work that we've done. We've already kind of finished that portion of the report. And so we'll include these different, you know, drivability, emissions, miles per gallon as sections within that E20 module.
And they might get released in advance of the November date, right?
Yeah, they could. Yeah. I mean, but for sure, that's when we run out of bucks here, so everything will have to be turned in by then.
I just wonder if that'd be helpful in us looking at the drivability question.
We've talked quite a bit with the folks out in Minnesota who did the initial kind of E20 work, and just to kind of get a sense of what the differences were between our program and theirs. They had a much more extensive drivability component to their program. They had professional drivers. It was done on a test track. I mean, they had very strict criteria that they used. So these were like, you know, like test pilot kind of stuff, and what we had is like normal line guys doing it. So if you're interested in that, I kind of refer you to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture website, which has the drivability results from their E20 test.
Okay, thank you.
Now this ends this year, right?
Correct, yeah. Our data collection effort will probably, you know, be cut off sometime this summer, and then we'll you know, basically be summarizing our results. Our emissions testing is all complete, so we're in the process of, you know, documenting that all right now. The only data we'd be collecting would be like ownership data or, you know, maintenance failures if things like that popped up later in the program.
So does anybody know if there are other plans to do much longer range testing to see how the engines hold up over time?
You know, my own personal view on this, having gone to the meeting in D.C. a couple weeks ago, is that primarily everybody's kind of target fixated on this E15 waiver right now. That once that gets pushed through either up, thumbs up or thumbs down, then everybody's going to kind of back off and relax a little bit, I think, because there's a number of people that are humping pretty hard to get those results completed. And there's a lot of work around catalytic converters, evaporative emissions, you know, material testing, component level testing, that kind of stuff. So there's still a lot of work to be done on that issue before the end of this year. I don't think anybody's really kind of in charge of the whole effort. I mean, it seems to me that EPA's mission is to verify that the emissions are low, but there isn't like a government agency that worries about engine durability. So, you know, that's kind of left up to everybody on their own.
That's a big boogeyman here.
Yeah, and the OEMs are doing whatever they need to do to worry about their warranties, but that's not the kind of information they're going to share with the general public, I don't think. So, I mean, our view is we need to do more long-term durability studies because there's maybe things out there we haven't identified that could pop up.
Yep. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, well, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you very much, Brian. Excellent presentation. And again, we do have some teleseminars scheduled in July. I'll be talking more with my colleagues at Transportation to see if we want to set something else up in June or just wait. So,
well, and we'd like to offer maybe next fall sometime we could do a similar seminar on our results from our biodiesel work and our engine dynamometer here. So that might be of interest to somebody.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay.
I'll follow up on that. Okay. Again, thank you all very much for participating.
Okay, thank you.
Great job. Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Yep, go ahead.